This is the Relic Radio Show, old-time radio entertainment still standing the test of time, from RelicRadio.com.
This is the Relic Radio Show, 1 hour of radio drama every Tuesday at RelicRadio.com. Our first story comes from the NBC University Theater this week. We'll hear their adaptation of Lord Jim from October 3rd, 1948. After that, it's The Six Shooter and Crisis at Easter Creek. That story aired April 15th, 1954.
This is the NBC University Theater, bringing you the second in our series of full-hour dramatizations of outstanding works in modern American and British fiction. Today, we present Brian Ahern in the title role of the Joseph Conrad novel, Lord Jim.
Powerfully built chap with a dogged self drive to him.
Aye, the same one, certainly. I've run into him in several of these eastern ports. Bombay, Calcutta, Rangoon, always worked as a water clerk.
Deucedly clever at it, too. But I hear he's full of black ingratitude. Ship chandler never knew when he'd throw up his job and leave suddenly without so much as a thank you. Mysterious of a sort.
Confounded fool, I'd say. Could have made a pretty penny if he'd stayed in one place. Jim, his name was, I think.
Hey, that's it, Jim. What was the last name?
Oh, come to think of it, I don't remember his ever having one. I say, that is a bit mysterious now.
Jim had another name, of course. But he was anxious that it should not be pronounced. His incognito was not meant to hide a personality, but a fact. And when the fact broke through, he would suddenly leave the seaport where he happened to be and move on to another, generally farther east. When his flight finally cut him off from white men, the Malays of the jungle added a word to the monosyllable of his incognito. They called him Tuan Jim. As one might say, Lord Jim. But that part comes near the end of my story. Let me begin at the beginning. Originally, he came from a parsonage. And between energetic son and pious, peaceful father, there was an enviable love and understanding.
Well, son, I thought we might talk about your future this afternoon. You'll soon be finished at the school here.
Yes, sir.
A little milk in your tea?
Oh, thank you.
As you know, the parsonage here has been handed down from father to son for generations. You would make a good minister, I believe.
Sir.
But my father let me make my own decision, and you shall make yours.
I want to go to sea, father.
To see. I'm not totally surprised. I've noticed your taste in literature. But are you positive, son? The life will not be always as depicted in romantic sea tales.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm very sure. It's the only life I want.
Well, if you can match your enthusiasm with tenacity, I've no doubt you'll make it a good life. I'll make arrangements for you to be sent to a training ship for officers of the mercantile marine.
Oh, thank you, Father. Thank you. You'll be proud of me, sir. I'll do big things.
Do the little things well, and I'll be satisfied. After all, you're my son. I think I'll warm my tea.
got on well and was generally liked. He had a steady head and an excellent physique. After 2 years of training, he went to sea. Yet in the routine of his days, he never lost his avidity for adventure and his sense of possessing many-sided courage. A leg accident caused him to put up at a hospital at an eastern port. His recovery was slow, and he was left behind. Well again, he took a berth as chief mate of the Patna, a local steamer as old as the hills and eaten up with rust, worse than a condemned water tank. She was commanded by a renegade German, who wore a blood and iron air combined with a purple nose and a red moustache.
Well, here come the cattle again.
The cattle? Oh, you mean our passengers?
You call them Arab pilgrims passengers? Cattle, covered with dust and sweat and grime. They sleep all over the deck on mats. This is your first trip, huh? After you keep stepping over them a few times, you'll swap them for pigs. Pigs is cleaner, maybe. Well, when they're all on, we'll shove off.
That was the first and last voyage Jim made on the Patna. I met him at the police court of an eastern port where the inquiry was being held. Yes, you see, another ship had picked up the captain, mate, and two engineers of the Patna in their lifeboat. But when they reached port, the captain deserted, and the two engineers were too ill to testify. So Jim was the whole show. The judges could get nothing from him, though. I know as much of what happened as any man alive will ever know, I suspect. It was after I had pressed Jim with the dinner invitation, and then served him some warming wine, that he opened up to me.
It's all in being ready. I wasn't. Not that night. Oh, I don't want to excuse myself, but I would like to explain. I would like somebody to understand. Somebody, one person at least. You. Why not you? You've been knowing kind.
I'd be happy to listen.
It bulged, I tell you. We'd hit something big and it bulged, I tell you. I was holding my lamp along the angle iron in the lower deck when a flake of rust as big as the palm of my hand fell off the plate all of itself.
That made you feel pretty bad, eh?
Do you suppose I was thinking of myself? With 160 people at my back? All fast asleep on the fore-tween deck, and more aft, sleeping and knowing nothing about it. 3 times as many as there were boats for, even if there'd been time.
And you felt there was no time?
I expected to see the iron open out as I stood there and the ocean rush in. In a split second, I lived what could happen. A sea whitened by the struggles of human beings, clamorous with the distress of cries for help. And there was no help. Oh, it seemed to take all the life out of my limbs. Do you think I was afraid of death? No, by heaven, no. But a voice, my own voice, kept speaking aloud inside my head. 800 people and 7 boats. 800 people and 7 boats. And no time. Oh, I don't know how long I stood there. Perhaps a minute. It was timeless. Well, when I finally got to the bridge, these beggars, the captain and the two engineers, were getting one of the boats off the chocks.
Ah, it's you. Lend a hand, quick. Quick, man.
Aren't you going to do something?
Yeah. Clear out.
What?
Clear out, you fool. This crate won't last another minute.
But these people...
I suppose you can save them, you crazy fool. Lend a hand here.
No. You mustn't leave them.
You'd rather die with them? Die, then. Hand me that hammer. We've got to work fast here.
I'm sure...
Oh, the sliding boat of the boat chock is jammed tight. Take the hammer to it, here.
Oh. I stood on the starboard side away from them. I wanted no part in their work. I can't remember thinking of anything, only waiting for the ship to suddenly dip into the sea.
Come on, help, for all that's holy. Come on, help.
I can't.
Oh, if I had the time, I'd crack your skull for you. Won't you save your own life, you infernal coward?
Let it sink, curse you.
Come and help, man. Are you mad to throw away your only chance? Come and help, man. Look, the squall's coming. We're done for in a few moments if we don't loose this thing.
It was black. Black. It had sneaked upon us from behind. I suppose there had been some hope at the back of my head yet. I don't know. But it was all over now. I was angry as though I'd been trapped. I, I was trapped.
Hammer, mine, got the hammer. You silly fool. Do you think you get the ghost of a show when all that lot of brutes is in the water? Why, they'll batter your head for you from these bouts.
The squall engulfed us now. The rain was blinding when one couldn't tell where it ended and when the ocean began. And just then, the jammed locks of the lifeboat gave way.
That does it.
Easy now. Lower her slow.
Careful there. Swing it out now. She's going.
Let her go.
Easy.
The next minute was crowded with a tumult of events and sensations that beat about me like the sea upon a rock. A squall had awakened many of the pilgrims. I didn't know what was happening, but they began to chatter wildly in their native tongue. The captain and the engineers had gotten down into the lifeboat. I stood with my hand on the davit. And then they began to scream from the boat.
Jump! We'll catch you!
The squall! We've got to shove off! Jump!
Jump!
We'll catch you!
Jump!
Next thing I remember, I was in the boat. I had jumped, it seems.
So it would seem.
I knew nothing about it till I looked up. And then I wished I could die. There was no going back. It was as if I'd jumped into a well, into an everlasting deep hole. Oh, yes. I know it very well. Certainly I jumped. I told you I jumped. But they were too much for any man. It was their doing, as plainly as if they'd reached up with a boat hook and pulled me over. Can't you see it? You must see it. Come, speak straight out.
You've been tried. I don't know what I would have done, nor does any man. And when the Avondale picked you up, you told them...
What I believed. As the first boat was lowered, the ship went into a squall, sank like lead. Oh, the story didn't matter. I jumped. That's what I have to live down. It was like cheating the dead.
And there were no dead.
No. The Patna was found the next day. Adrift. Was towed to Aden. If I'd only stayed on. Oh, what a chance missed. What a chance missed.
Not many men are offered a try at real heroism. Fewer still have dreamed and waited for it, as had Jim. Perhaps the world could have forgiven him his human failure, but he could never forgive himself. The outcome of the inquiry was as all had expected. Jim's certificate was cancelled. I did not seek him out after the trial, but I was extremely pleased when he casually walked into my room the next afternoon.
May I have a cigarette?
Help yourself. Here's a light.
Oh, thanks. Well, that's over.
Yes.
I wonder what's to come.
Why not visit home?
Never.
You're awfully fond of your dad. I can tell.
That's no secret.
And he'd be...
I'd have been in all the papers by now. Oh, I'll never go back again.
But look
here... I'd rather not discuss it.
Sorry.
No better than a vagabond now. Without a single... Well, someday one's bound to come upon some sort of chance to get it all back again. Must.
Perhaps. Life's long enough. Don't reckon too much on it.
I feel as if nothing could ever touch me again.
You still won't take the money that's due you from the Patna? I suppose you intend to eat and drink and sleep under shelter in the usual way. What will you do tomorrow? Where will you turn?
That isn't the thing.
You've got to live. On every conceivable ground, you must let me help you.
You can't.
But I can.
No, I won't take money.
Upon my word, you deserve being told to go to blazes. It isn't a question of money at all. Look at this letter. I'm writing to a man of whom I've never asked a favor. I make myself unreservedly responsible for you. He'll give you a job with his firm, a rice mill.
Joe, you're a brick. Why, this is what I... You... well, you don't mind my not saying anything appropriate. There isn't anything one can say.
Oh, no.
All right, I'll shut up. But you can't stop me from thinking, though. Never mind. I'll show you yet. I always thought if a fellow could start with a clean slate. And now you, in a measure... Yes, a clean slate. I'll show you.
Six months afterwards, my friend wrote me of Jim. He was highly pleased with his work, as well as his personality. Jim had a chance for big advancements. Then, after a few more months, I chanced to stop at the city where my friend lived. I was looking forward to seeing Jim, too, but... not with you any longer. But I thought you liked him. What happened?
What happened? Exactly. You tell me. I was deucedly fond of him. Even had him stay here on my own. And last month I come down to breakfast one morning and found a note from him. He'd gone. Sorry. That was all. Allow me to say, lest you should have some more mysterious young men in reserve, that I have shut up shop.
But he must have given a reason. Think hard.
No. No. Well, there was, but that couldn't have been a reason for...
What? What did you just think?
Oh, a trifle. I hired a man to look after some machinery at the mill. Jim didn't seem to like him much, but he was such an insignificant fellow, really.
Why didn't he like him?
Dash it all, I don't know. I remember, though, he got rather upset when the fellow mentioned they'd been on a ship somewhere together. By the way, you didn't tell me...
Was the ship the Patna?
Could have been. Yes, no, think it was. Yes, the Patna.
One chance in 100. But it's always that 100th chance. And Jim had been forced to move on, had forced himself, and thrown over a fortune. The next I heard from him, he was a water clerk for Ekstrom and Blake, ship chandlers in a still more eastern port. When my ship put in there, I went to the offices. Ekstrom told me the story this time.
Oh, him. Oh, he left us, Captain.
When did he leave?
Well, let's see. The very day a steamer with returning pilgrims from the Red Sea put in here with two blades of a propeller gun. 3 weeks ago now.
Wasn't there something said about the Patna case?
Why, yes. Come to think of it, Captain, how did you know? The two ships were compared. Then they started on about the Patna like most people do. The interesting case, you know. Jim was here at the time having a sandwich and a glass of beer, and suddenly, sir, that blasted Jim, he puts down the sandwich he had in his hand and walks around the table and says to me just like this,
I'm shoving off.
Oh, no need to hurry out for the next job, Jimmy. It is now past one yet. You might snatch a smoke first.
I'm off for good, leaving you.
Huh? What?
That's it.
Oh, a rise in the wage. Oh, that's the trouble, is it? Oh, well, all right. There's no need of all that fuss with me, Jimmy. Just mention your figure, anything in reason. You're good at your job and worth the price.
No, I can't stop with you.
Huh? What's the blooming joke, lad?
No joke. I've got to go.
What is it you're running away from? Who's been getting at you? Where did you expect to find a better berth?
No place.
Oh, look here, this business ain't going to sink.
I give you my word. If you knew my reasons, you wouldn't care to keep me.
That's the biggest lie you ever told in your life.
I know my own mind.
Can't you really stop long enough to drink this glass of beer, you funny beggar, you?
Goodbye. You're not half a bad chap, Ekstrom.
Well, if you're in such a hurry, here's luck to you in your own drink. Well, mark my words, if you keep up this game, you'll sure find that the earth ain't big enough to hold you.
Goodbye.
Gave me one black look. Out he rushed with a face fit to scare little children. Haven't been able to get a man that was any good since. Where might you have come across him, Captain, if it's fair to ask?
He was the mate of the Patna that voyage.
And who the devil cares about that?
I dare say no one. Save himself. I have told you these two episodes at length to show his manner of dealing with himself under the new conditions of his life. There were many others of the sort, more than I could count on the fingers of my two hands. There seemed no place else he could escape to. It was then I went to see Stein, a wealthy and respected merchant who dealt in island produce on a large scale. I told Stein Jim's story.
I understand very well. He is romantic, yeah.
What's to be done for it?
There is only one remedy. The question is not how to get cured, but how to live.
Yes, I know.
I tell you, my friend, it is not good for you to find you cannot make your dream come true for the reason that you are not strong enough or not clever enough. Yeah? There is one way. Follow the dream. Follow the dream.
Well, it's too late for that now.
Then perhaps another way. He could be buried.
Buried?
Away from those who remind him of his lost dream.
But he's traveled 3,000 miles, and it follows him.
He has never been to Patusan.
Patusan?
A remote district of a native ruled state.
Oh.
No one ever goes there. No one would ever wish to. I have a small trading post there.
You think Jim could manage it?
He could do no worse than the man I have there now.
White or native?
A Moluccan Portuguese named Cornelius. Worthless, conniving fellow. His wife was a fine woman, though. She had a daughter by her first marriage who stays on with Cornelius.
If Jim takes the post, will you bring this Cornelius back?
I doubt he would leave. It does not matter to me. But we should warn your Jim. Cornelius may well make trouble for him.
The afternoon I stood on the dock saying goodbye to Jim. He was as excited and voluble as a youngster on the eve of a long holiday.
This is what I've been waiting for. I've been dreaming of it. By Jove, I'll show you yet. I'm ready for any confounded thing. This is luck at last. You wait.
I hope you'll go in the proper frame of mind, Jim.
I'm in a perfect frame of mind.
You may not want to remain.
Remain? Of course I shall. Only get me in and I'll never leave.
Don't be foolhardy. If you only live long enough, you'll want to come back.
Come back to what?
All right. Forget I mentioned it. But at least be prepared for what you'll meet when you get there. Stein warned you of the worrying and pillaging that goes on between the native factions of Patusan, didn't he?
Yes, yeah, sure. That decadent Rajah and the bandit Sheriff Ali, all of that.
All of that can become a bit annoying when you're there without help.
Oh, but I'll have help, you know. That old chap called Doramine, one of the principal men out there, is a great friend of Mr. Stein's, and he'll be my friend, too. Oh, I say, don't look at me that way. I promised to take care of myself. Yes, yes, yes.
That's better.
I won't take any risks. Of course I won't. I mean to hang out, so don't you worry. By Jove, I feel as if nothing could touch me. Why, this is luck from the word go. I wouldn't spoil such a magnificent chance. It's a magnificent chance.
Jim's coming to Patusan was a blessing. But to them, as to many of us, the blessing came heralded by terrors. Doramine and his son Dane Waris befriended Jim, it is true, but the tribe they headed was only a small part of the population. And the rest of the natives under the Raja's rule feared the white god new to their midst. Jim took up quarters with Cornelius. This was a mistake, since Cornelius was part of the plot to get rid of him.
You really must leave. Surely you know your life is in danger at every minute.
Cornelius, you have been whispering in my ears the plans that have been made for my murder for weeks now, and so far nothing's even threatened me.
So far, so far.
A man can become even contemptuous of his own suicide when it becomes such a familiar threat.
They will do it, I tell you.
Let them try. Once.
It will be too late then. On their first attempt, they will succeed. I know these people.
I'm getting to know them too, however. I think they fear me, Cornelius.
Just that. Just that. You have no time to lose. For your safety, only with the thought of your safety, I have gone to great pains to devise a plan.
A plan?
For your escape. A great deal of trouble on my part, and for only $100. Even 80? Yes, let's say 80. I can procure a trustworthy man who will smuggle you out of the land. No one will ever know what happened to you.
Probably even I won't know.
Oh, you must trust me. I am your only friend. You must trust me for only $80. A small sum for your life. Oh, you must not laugh. You must trust me. Think of the danger I am risking by staying behind. They will surely know it was I who helped you escape. But I don't think of myself, no, only of you. You must leave if you care a pin for your life.
That's just it, Cornelius. If it means running away, I don't care a pin.
No? You refuse? You insist on staying?
I am staying.
Then your blood be on your own head. I shan't try to befriend you any longer.
It's quite all right with me. I'm going to live in Petusan.
You shall die here.
But Cornelius's warnings were not all idle, and events would have taken a bad turn for Jim if he had not had a protectress, the daughter of Cornelius's wife, whom Jim called Jewel.
Get up. Get up. Get up.
Huh? Hey, huh? What?
You must wake up.
Why? What's happened? You all right?
Yes, but you are in great danger. They have come to kill you.
Oh, I've heard this too often.
No, it's true. Here's your gun. Take it. I have loaded it.
But
there is no time to lose. Can you face four men with your gun?
Yes.
Then come with me. I'll hold the torch high so you can see your way along the path. Now, come.
But you must tell me what this is all about.
Four men are hiding in that hut over there, to the right. They intend murdering you while you slept. I heard Cornelius talking with them.
Oh, they've plotted many times, Jewel.
But I know when they mean to carry it through. You think I have watched on this night only?
You?
Please do not stop. Walk quickly.
There's someone coming.
I can't.
It's Cornelius. Hey, Cornelius!
They know you are awake now. Your voice. You must run away. They know you are strong and fearless. Run to Doramin. Go to Doramin.
I am strong and fearless. Why?
Yes. So they won't attack you tonight. But what about tomorrow night? And the next? Of the many, many nights? Can I always be watching?
If I am fearless, then let me be. They're in that shed?
Yes.
I'm going in.
No, then I'll come with you.
No, you stay here.
No. I will hold the torch in through the window. You could see nothing without it. And we'll run now. Now, push open the door. Fire! Defend yourself!
Why, there's no one here.
No, look. That heap of dirty mats. Eyes are watching us.
Come out. Come out, I say!
He has a knife. Why don't you shoot?
Jim held his shot deliberately. Held it for the tenth part of a second. For three strides of the man. Held it for the pleasure of saying to himself,
that's a dead man.
He noticed the dilated nostrils, the wide eyes, the intent, eager stillness of the face. And then he fired. He saw the man jerk his head up, fling his arms forward, and drop the knife. He had shot him through the mouth. With the impetus of his rush, the man drove straight on and landed with terrific violence on his forehead, just short of Jim's bare toes. The place was getting very full of sooty smoke from the torch. Jim walked over the body and covered with his revolver another naked figure, outlined vaguely at the other end. As he was about to pull the trigger, the man threw away his short, heavy spear and squatted submissively.
You want your life? How many more of you are there?
Two more, Tuan.
Accordingly, two more crawled from under the mats, holding out their empty hands to Lord Jim.
From From Hollywood, the NBC University Theater is bringing you Brian Ahern in Lord Jim by Joseph Conrad, another in our special series of dramatizations of great English and American novels. Our intermission commentator today is Dr. Harvey C. Webster of the University of Louisville, where these productions are currently being used in conjunction with his course in Anglo-American fiction as part of a national college by radio plan, which permits our listeners to earn credit toward a college degree by means of radio. Now, here to comment on today's novel, Lord Jim, is the distinguished author and lecturer, Dr. Harvey C. Webster, speaking to you from Louisville.
And say they're usually pessimistic thoughts, many read Conrad as philosopher and accept or reject him as they accept or reject what they think Conrad thinks. This is unfortunate. An artist, especially a great one like Conrad, is more than his philosophy, more than his experience, above, in spite of himself, his prejudices. Typhoon, one of Conrad's best tales, is not only about its title, it is also about man's courage, nature's apparent hostility, and much else. Victory, the only Conrad novel I like better than Lord Jim, is not a pessimistic sermon, or a melodrama, or an exhibition of the beautiful English a man born in Poland can write. Victory is a seeing of life that sometimes includes pessimism and melodrama, that is written in beautiful prose, and a great deal more. What you take away from the seeing of life in Victory, in Lord Jim, in all of Conrad's fiction, depends on you, your maturity, your patience, your sensitivity. Conrad himself has put this better than I have. My task, he says, is to make you hear, to make you feel. It is before all to make you see. If I succeed, you shall find there, according to your deserts, encouragement, consolation, fear, charm, all you demand, and, perhaps, also that glimpse of truth for which you have forgotten to ask. At his best, in youth, Victory, Lord Jim, Under Western Eyes, Nostromo, The Heart of Darkness, in perhaps five or six others, Conrad does make you hear, feel, and see, so that you can find in his books what you deserve to find. I hope that you deserve greatly, for there is much to find in the Conrad novels. I hope you'll start reading or rereading when this program is over.
Thank you, Dr. Webster. Our dramatization of Lord Jim continues from Hollywood after a brief pause for station identification.
I visited Pat Dusan 2 years after Jim's arrival. It was inconceivable how many things he had regulated over the entire island, the good he had done the people. When the natives spoke of Tuan Jim, their tone was a strange mixture of familiarity and awe. Jim had a very fine house in the native style. His life there with Jewel was as typical and devoted as the happiest couple in a London suburb. And as for Jim himself, I think he was almost satisfied. Almost satisfied. What man can hope for much more?
Peaceful here, eh? Look at those houses down in the valley below. There's not one where I'm not trusted. I told you I'd hang on. Ask any man, woman, or child.
I don't have to. I see it in their faces.
Well, I'm all right, anyhow.
I never had any doubt of it, Jim. I'm glad you found out in the end.
By Jove, only think what it is to me. I've got back my confidence in myself. A good name. You know, sometimes I wish...
That you could go back and prove it to the others?
No. No, I shall hold on to what I've got. I can't expect anything more. Not out there in the world, anyhow. No, this is my limit, because because nothing less will do.
Then you have no desire to leave for any personal happiness?
Leave? It'll be harder than dying. No, on my word, don't laugh. Every day, every time I open my eyes, I feel that I'm trusted. And then there's Jewel. I love her dearly. More than I could tell.
And she adores you?
Yes. You take a different view of your actions when you come to understand, when you're made to understand every day that your existence is necessary. Absolutely necessary to another person. I'm made of your happiness. It's wonderful. I've been only 2 years here, and now, upon my word, I can't conceive of living anywhere else.
Jim, you said you were all right now. Does that mean, too, you've forgotten why you came here?
Not yet. And yet, upon my soul, I think I've a right to. And perhaps someday... Isn't it strange that all these people who would do anything for me could never be made to understand? If you ask them who is brave, who is true, who is just, who is it that they would trust with their lives, they would say Tuan Jin. And yet they can never know the real, real truth.
There was one person in Patusan who felt the shadow of the truth, however, without knowing. And for her, it became a haunting fear. I sensed that Jewel had been waiting for an opportunity to speak with me alone. It came one evening when Jim, followed by his faithful servant Tammy Tam, had started on his rounds.
You come to take him away?
No. Upon my word, I did not come for that.
Why did you come, then?
I have business here with Jim. And more than that, we're great friends, you know. Believe me, my dear, if I have any wish in the matter, it is for him to stay, not leave.
They always leave us.
You're wrong. Nothing can separate him from you.
That is what he said. He swore it to me.
Did you ask him?
Oh, no, never. In the beginning, I asked him to leave. I begged him to. But he said he could not, that it was impossible. I begged him to leave. I was thinking of his safety, but I was trying to save myself, too.
Save yourself?
I did not want to die weeping, as my mother did. I wanted him to leave before it was too late for me.
But you say he swore to you he would stay.
Yes.
And is it possible that you... You do not believe him.
Other men have sworn the same thing. My father did.
But he's not like that.
Why is he different? Is he better? Is he...
On my word of honor, I believe he is.
Tell me, is he more true?
More true than any other man. Fear shall never drive him away from you.
What is it, then? What is it? There is something he can never forget. I know... Yet I don't know. He says he has been afraid. How can I believe this? You all remember something. You all go back to it. You tell me. What is this thing? Has it got a face and a voice? Will he see it? Will he hear it in his sleep, perhaps, when he cannot see me? And then will he arise and go? I shall never forgive him. My mother forgave, but I never.
I can understand your fear, but it is unfounded. There's nothing, nothing in that outside unknown world, nothing living or dead, no voice, no power that can tear Jim from your side. No one wants him.
No one?
No one.
Why? Why? Tell me why.
You really... Want to know?
Oh, yes, yes.
Because he's not good enough.
But that is the very thing he said. You lie, both of you.
I called after her. I tried to explain that no one was good enough, really. But she ran from me. and seeing Jim coming, I slipped away. As I walked down the path, Cornelius ran up to me. He had an eager, craving look on his sour, yellow little face. Even his groveling aspect could not hide the hate that was eating him up.
Look at me, honorable sir, look at me. The most unhappy of men, a victim, crushed. And I tried to befriend him and see what I got.
You befriend Jim? What are you talking about?
Don't walk away. Forgive me, honorable sir. Spare me a moment more. My great misfortunes have affected my head, honorable sir. I say things I don't mean. Please, the honorable sir doesn't know what it means to be broken down, ruined, trampled upon. But if you could put yourself in my position, perhaps you...
What are you getting at, Cornelius?
You could perhaps, honorable sir, speak to him in my behalf. Eh? Only a moderate provision, I ask. A small present.
Present? For what?
In exchange for the girl. I brought her up, honorable sir, another man's child. It was great trouble and pain. And now I'm an old man. If the honorable sir would say a word, and you could tell him for a suitable present, I'd be willing to take the girl back again.
Take her back?
Yes, honorable sir, when the time comes for the gentleman to go home.
In this case, Cornelius, the time shall never come.
What?
Haven't you heard him say so himself? He will never go home.
This is too much. He comes here, devil knows from where, comes here to trample on me till I die. Till I die. But patience. Patience. We shall see. We shall see. He cannot steal everything from me and get away with it. We shall see.
It all began about a year later with a man named Brown. Gentleman Brown, he was ironically called, who with a small but cold-blooded band pillaged the helpless native villages of the eastern seas. But he was down on his luck now. And it was for food, mostly, that Gentleman Brown picked on Patusan.
Patusan. Probably a largest native village, sure to be defenseless, boys. And with lots of provisions to lay our hands on. Bullocks, rice, sweet potatoes. Maybe even enough to stock a cargo and make a little change to boot. We'll roast their toes rather than be balked.
But Gentleman Brown had not counted on the influence of Chuan Jim on the well-stocked ammunition stores. Though Jim was away on a trip to the interior, the natives on the Dane Waris within a few hours had forced the invaders to seek protection behind a blockade on a small knoll. The situation seemed hopeless for Gentleman Brown until Cornelius arrived and opened his eyes to the home affairs of Patusan.
Yes, there are possibilities, I tell you, immense possibilities. Perhaps we could work together and beat him.
But who is this white lord you've been raving about? What's his name?
Jim.
That's not enough for a man's name. What is he? Where does he come from? Is he an Englishman?
Yes, but he's a fool. All you have to do is kill him, and then you are king.
Perhaps I could persuade him we should work together, that we could share things, and once I got to the powder supply, I'd be in charge. An argument would start between us. It only takes one shot, you know.
Yes, and then you would be master.
What's that?
He has come.
Already? Are you sure?
They are sounding the drums for him.
Oh, why such a row?
For joy. He is a very great man, but all the same, he knows no better than a child.
Well, now, look here. How is one to get to him?
He will come to talk to you.
What do you mean? Come down here strolling, as it were?
Yes. He's just that much of a fool. You shall see what a fool he is. You shall see. He is not afraid of anything. He will order you to leave his people alone. He's just like a little child. He will order you to leave his people alone. And then, Captain, you tell that tall man with a gun who's such a good shot to shoot him. Just you kill him and you shall frighten everybody so much. You can do anything you like with them afterwards. Fine. Yes, fine.
Who are you?
My name's Brown. Captain Brown. What's yours?
Jim did not answer this question, but stood looking at the men on the other side of the small creek.
What made you come here?
You want to know? It's easy to tell. Hunger. And what made you?
Not for hunger, and not for plunder.
We were driven to it. We came here for food, you hear? Food to fill our stomachs. We don't ask for anything but to give us a fight on a clear road to go back whence we came.
I would fight with you now.
And I would let you shoot me in welcome. This is as good a jumping off place for me as any. But by heaven, I'm not the sort to jump out of trouble and leave my men in a lurch.
What did you do out there on the outside to be driven to this?
Have we met to tell each other the story of our lives? I won't ask you what scared you into this infernal hole where you seem to have found pretty pickings. That's your luck and this is mine. The privilege to beg to be shot quickly or else to go free and starve in my own way.
Will you promise to leave the coast and to surrender your arms?
Surrender our arms? Not till you come and take them out of our stiff hands. You think I've gone crazy?
Very well. You shall have a clear road or else a clear fight.
Henceforth, events moved fast. Jim returned to the council meeting of the natives over which Duramin presided, but he spoke with unaccustomed difficulty.
Everybody shall be safe. You have my word for it. I, who put the happiness and the safety of you, my people, above all else.
But are they not bloodthirsty robbers bent on killing, Tuan?
They are erring men whom suffering has made blind to right and wrong. Oh, it's true that lives have been lost already, but why lose more?
Their evil deeds should be punished.
No, wait, hear me, please.
Let Tuan continue.
It's true they've killed some of our people. We've killed some of theirs. But a fight will only heap new evils upon the old. Have I ever ill-advised you? Have my words ever brought suffering to you?
You have always been our friend.
I am one of you. Your welfare is my welfare. Your losses, my losses. And your mournings, my mournings. And so I say, I think it would be best to let these whites and their followers go and live their lives. It would be a small gift. I, whom you have tried and always found true, ask you to let them go. What is your command, O Doramin?
I have no trust for the white men on the hill. It seems to me they should be punished. But I do trust you, Tuan Jim. If you say it is best they go, let it be so.
The message was sent to Gentleman Brown, and Tamitam, Jim's servant, was dispatched with a message to Dane Warris, who waited with an encampment farther down the river, that the white men should be allowed to pass unmolested. But a new member was aboard the invaders' boat as it made its way along the foggy river this time. A man with a thirst for revenge in his eyes. The man was Cornelius.
You should have killed the Tuan when you had a chance.
That would have done no good. Well, at least we're getting out alive. And he sent a bit of food to boot.
A bit of food, bah. When you could have had the gold and precious stuff. The place is full of it.
Huh?
Yes, he stole it. Why could you not have taken it from him? You have as much right.
Gold? He tricked me.
Oh, now you see it. What a fool you were.
Nah, it's too late now.
For the gold, perhaps. Not for revenge.
Hmm?
Dane Voris is encamped farther down the river with a band of warriors.
So?
And I'll tell you something else, Captain. I know another way along this river. One that will take us behind, not in front of Dane Voris' camp.
Oh?
If you were quiet, they would never hear us approach. They'd be looking for us the other way. And this fog makes an extra covering.
Can you find your way in the soup?
I have lived here a long time.
I'll follow your directions.
It was an act of cool-blooded ferocity. Gentleman Brown's revenge upon the world which, after 20 years of contemptuous and reckless bullying, refused him the tribute of a common robber's success. When Tammy Tam, paddling madly, got back to the town, the women were looking out for the return of Dane Warris's fleet of little boats. The town had a festive air. Tammy Tam, panting, with trembling lips and wild eyes, rushed to the house of Lord Jim.
Sire, Tammy Tam, Tuan, with tidings that cannot wait.
Yes, come in. What's wrong?
This, Tuan, is a day of evil, an accursed day.
Speak out.
It was most cruel treachery. They came up behind the camp. They have shot Dane Warris and many more.
Is Dane Warris dead?
He ran out at the first shots and fell. They will be bringing his body back soon to his father, Doramine.
Order a fleet of boats out for immediate pursuit. We'll repay them for this. Why do you stand there? Waste no time.
Forgive me, Tuan.
What?
It is not safe any longer for thy servant to go out amongst the people.
Jim understood at once. He had retreated from one world for a small matter of an impulsive jump. And now the other world, the work of his own hands, had fallen in ruins upon his head. He sat alone in his room all day. He would not even speak with Jewel. Later, toward evening, he called Tammy Tam.
Well?
There is much weeping, much anger, too.
What does the council say? You know?
Luckily, we have the powder here. We'll have to fight.
Fight? What for?
For our lives.
I have no life.
Oh, no. Do not speak so.
Tam, I give you and my other servants leave to depart to your homes.
For how long, Tuan?
For all time. It is time to finish this.
Will you not fight?
There's nothing to fight for. Nothing is lost.
Then will you fly? Shall we fly?
There is no escape.
And you shall go. Oh, you are mad or false. Do you remember the night I prayed you to leave me? You said that you could not, that it was impossible. Impossible. Do you remember you said you would never leave me? Why? I asked you for no promise.
Quiet, Jewel. I should not be worth having.
Oh, yes. You are mine. Will you defend yourself?
Nothing can touch me.
Oh, but I shall hold you with my arms so. You are mine. I will not let you go.
Let me go. Jewel, I must.
Oh, no. Come back. Oh, you are false. False.
Forgive me.
Never. Never.
Jim Jim got into his boat, without looking back once on the girl crumpled upon the ground, he paddled to Doramin's camp home. Tamitam had come this far with Jim, but the Tuan forbade him to go any farther. Torches twinkled here and there. Wailing filled the night air. The body of Dane Waris lay on a low couch in front of his father. Doramin, alone and desolate, sat in his armchair with a pair of flintlock pistols on his knees, faced by the throng of mourners. Many were whispering,
"He has worked all the evil.
He brought us disaster."
Jim heard their words. When he came into the light of the torches, the wailing ceased suddenly. Doramin did not lift his head. Jim stood silent before him for a time. The people began to murmur in a surprised tone.
"He came! He came!"
"He has taken it upon his own head."
"Yes, upon my own head. I am come in sorrow. I am come ready and unarmed. I have come to say goodbye to my friend, Dane Waris, and to stand before the great Doramin. Yes, I take it upon my own head."
Doramin stood, tottering a bit. His eyes stared with an expression of mad pain and rage. And then, while Jim stood stiffened and with bared head in the light of torches, he lifted his right arm deliberately and shot his son's friend through the chest. They say that the white man sent right and left at all those faces a proud and unflinching glance. Then, with his hand over his lips, he fell forward, dead. And that's the end. He passes away under a cloud, instant, forgotten, unforgiven, and excessively romantic. Not in could he have seen the alluring shape of such an extraordinary success. For it may very well be that in the short moment of his last proud and unflinching glance, he had beheld the face of that opportunity which, like an Eastern bride, had come veiled to his side.
The curtain falls on the second in our new series of full-hour dramatizations of outstanding works in modern British and American fiction. Today, the NBC University Theater has brought you an adaptation by Agnes Eckert of the Joseph Conrad novel Lord Jim, starring Brian Ahern, internationally celebrated star of stage and screen. Our cast included Donald Morrison, narrator, Norman Field, Rolf Sedan, Jerome Sheldon, Paul McVeigh, Jack Crucian, Sidney Miller, Maya Gregory, Joseph Granby, Victor Perrin. Intermission commentator today was Dr. Harvey C. Webster of the University of Louisville, where productions of the NBC University Theater are currently being used in conjunction with his course in Anglo-American fiction under a special College by Radio plan. Next week at this time, the NBC University Theater will present another great work, this time by an American author, Theodore Dreiser's An American Tragedy. Your director was Andrew C. Love. Original music for Lord Jim was composed by Albert Harris and conducted by Henry Russell. NBC University Theater came to you from Hollywood. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
In a moment, you'll hear James Stewart as the Six Shooter, just one of many fine programs brought to you each week on NBC. Tomorrow night, there's top comedy entertainment with The Bob Hope Show, The Phil Harris Alice Faye Show, and Can You Top This with Senator Ford. Bob Hope delivers rapid-fire comedy routines, while Phil Harris and Alice Faye bring both mirth and music. It's a great Friday night lineup of comedy programs, all of them heard only on NBC. James Stewart as the Six Shooter. The man in the saddle is angular and long-legged. His skin is sun-dyed brown. The gun in his holster is gray steel and rainbow mother of pearl. Its handle, unmarked. People call them both the Six Shooter. The NBC Radio Network presents James Stewart as the Six Shooter, a transcribed series of radio dramas based on the life of Britt Ponsett, the Texas plainsman who wandered through the Western territories, leaving behind a trail of still-remembered legends.
Attended a Tuesday evening choir practice in quite a spell, but when Reverend Broom stopped by the Tropical Ranch where I was working and asked me if I could manage to take part in this week's rehearsal, well, I sure couldn't see how to do any harm, so I... Ringing in the sheaves, we shall come rejoicing, ringing in the sheaves. Anyhow, there we are. About 10 of us all gathered around at John Farley's general store, it was. You see, the town of Easter Creek didn't have a regular church building yet. They held their services and social affairs in the mercantile while they went ahead trying to raise money to put up a community church. It was during the second verse of Bringing in the Sheaves that things started sounding a little peculiar, sort of like the voices and the music were sort of traveling different trails. First, I thought it was me. I never have been exactly what you'd call melodious, but then the other folks were beginning to have their troubles, too. And holy smokes, it just was getting terrible. And finally, Mrs. Peebles, she was the organist, she just threw up her hands and stopped even trying to play.
Well, we'll have Mr. Farley take another look at it, Elvira. I'm sure he'll be able to get it back into shape.
There's nothing Mr. Farley can do, or anybody else. It's plain wore out. You can't expect a thing to last forever.
Well, no, of course
not.
Seems
to me that after all this time, something could have been done about buying a new organ. When I donated this one to the congregation, I didn't suppose I'd have to go on playing it all the rest of my life. But apparently that's what's expected.
Now, there's no need to upset yourself, Elvira.
Well, I can't help being upset. I say I can't help it. How do you think I feel every Sunday? All those sour notes, and that wheezing and whining. Folks are beginning to think that it's me, that it's my playing. Well, I've been humiliated for the last time, and I won't go through it again.
But Elvira, we gotta have music for Easter service.
Music? Well, you certainly don't call that music, do you? Good night, Reverend Bruce.
Oh, somebody get back. All right, everybody. give me your attention, please? Attention, folks. Quiet down now, please. Quiet down. It appears that matters have come to a serious crisis. It's bad enough for a town by the name of Easter Creek not to have a proper building for Easter services. But to be without an organ and an organist, well, it's a disgrace, a positive disgrace. Now, we mustn't blame Miss Peebles. That instrument has seen its best days, there's no doubt about it. So I propose that we take immediate steps to purchase a replacement.
Just one thing, Reverend Boone.
Yes, sir.
Where's the money coming from?
Well, now, I've given that matter serious thought, Sheriff Appleton, and there seems to be only one possible solution to the problem. We'll just have to borrow from the building fund.
Sort of like robbing Peter to pay Paul, isn't it?
No, not exactly, not exactly. Seeing as how we haven't reached our $1,000 goal anyway, well, the money's just sort of lying there.
I don't know about that.
Just how much do you figure a new organ will cost, Reverend Bruce?
Well, I've done some investigating in the field, Mrs. Appleton. Last month, when Elvira's foot went through the pump pedal, it seemed like the situation was coming to head. The church over to Whitefield purchased a new organ just last Christmas, and they're willing to sell us their old one. It's used, of course, but it's still in excellent repair. And they're only asking $95.
I'm afraid that's a bit more than we can afford, Reverend.
We must have at least $95 in the building fund. We've been putting money aside for the last year.
No, we ain't. We got $42.50. That's the total. Up to and including $3.65 in the cake bazaar a month ago.
$42.50?
Yep.
I just had no idea.
We're shy over $50 from what it would take to buy the organ. And there just isn't any way we could raise it. Not between now and Easter.
Now. We mustn't give up. After all, we only need $50.
$52.50.
Yes, exactly. Let's see. There was just someone who could take a firm grip of the situation. A man who... Mr. Ponson.
Yes, Reverend.
Mr. Ponson, I know you aren't a regular member of our congregation, and you've only been in our midst a few months. But,
well, I sure be glad to donate what I can to the cause, Reverend, but I'm afraid it'd only be a drop in the bucket.
Oh, a donation wasn't exactly what I had in mind.
Oh?
I think perhaps you can be of more service in another fashion. Ladies and gentlemen, I propose that we appoint Britt Ponson a committee of one to take charge of the organ raising.
Now hold on a minute here, Reverend Broome.
We all know that you're a man of strength and determination, Mr. Ponson. That you inspire confidence, and we trust generosity.
Well, now, I'd sure like to oblige you folks, but what you're asking is just out of the question, that's all.
You wouldn't turn us down in our hour of need.
No, I'm not turning you down exactly. What I mean is, it just couldn't be done. Why, you've been a whole year raising $42.50, and now you're talking about raising over $50 in just a few days.
Well, we've been going at it the wrong way, Mr. Ponson.
What?
I'm sure your approach will be 100% more effective.
My approach?
Why, certainly. And just to show you how easy it'll be, we'll start things off by taking up a collection right now. Sheriff Appleton, will you pass the hat?
But,
all right, everybody. Dig down deep. It's a wonderful thing Mr. Ponsett's doing in taking over this fundraising campaign.
But I never said
a
word.
And here's our chance to let him know how much we appreciate it.
Reverend. Well, the sheriff finished passing the hat and poured it out on the table. And Reverend Broome counted it. $2.50. And yet the reverend was real pleased, too. He said that meant that I only had $50 to go. A nice round number. Well, not that I had any intention of taking this job of raising the money to get the new organ, you understand. I told the reverend I couldn't do it. I told him just as plain as day that I couldn't do it. But somehow he got the idea that I had already agreed to do it. And no matter how hard I talked, he just kept... And the other folks, they were as bad as Reverend Broome. They are just outnumbered. So all there was to it. So, early the next morning, I took my hat in my hand and started out. Must have been getting around noon when I finally came back to the sheriff's office.
Oh, come in, Bet. Come in.
Morning, Abner.
Well, how's everything going? You been out collecting?
Yeah, I've been collecting.
Well?
Well, $11. That's what I got so far.
$11, huh? That's remarkable, Bet. Simply remarkable.
But the trouble is, I've already asked everybody in town. Except you, that is.
Oh, well, I suppose I could give you a dollar, but don't forget I was in on the collection at choir practice. You ain't serious, Brett. You don't mean you really ask everybody else.
As a matter of fact, there is one area I sort of skipped over.
Oh?
Well, those cabins over east of the creek and the ranches out that way. I haven't visited them yet.
Well, you'd just be wasting your time if you did.
I would,
Yeah, those folks wouldn't be very anxious to help out at church. Mess of thieves, cattle rustlers, every other kind of riffraff.
Oh, is that what they are? Oh,
well, now, that's just a general sense of opinion. And of course, if I could know for certain that we had any actual outlaws living around Easter Creek, if I was positive, that is, well, it'd be my duty to arrest them.
I see,
But the fact is, they ain't caused any trouble here in town, none of them. And I can't go around arresting people on rumors. Well, can I, Britt?
I understand Red Eye Kirk has a place somewhere east of town, doesn't he?
That's hearsay, Britt. Pure and simple hearsay.
Oh, I see.
Why, you don't think I'd let a notorious gunfighter like Red Eye live right here under my nose, do you?
Well, it's too bad he's not in these parts.
Oh?
No, I was thinking I might like to pay him a little visit.
Well, what on earth for?
Well, as long as he's not in the neighborhood, I guess it doesn't matter. Kind of a shame, though.
Well, now, if you're really anxious to... what I mean is... but they do say there's a fellow who somewhat resembles Red Eye. He's got himself a cabin just this side of Deer Mountain.
Just this side of Deer Mountain, huh?
Well, wait a minute, Red. Wait a minute. What in thunder did you want to get mixed up with Red Eye Kirk for? What's he got to do with raising money for a new organ?
Well, A probably won't have anything to do with it, but it's just that I don't want to leave any stones unturned, you see. So long, Abner. It was about a half hour's ride out to the cabin Sheriff Applin told me about. Not much of a cabin, though. Just a shack at the foot of Deer Mountain with a corral off one side. There sure were a lot of different brands on the horses in that corral. Well, I pulled up in the yard about 15 feet from the cabin door. For a minute, it didn't seem like there was anybody at home. And then I heard the door start to creak open. The barrel of a .45 poked into sight. The man behind it was tall, square-shouldered, and thick black beard, and kind of reddish eyes. Howdy.
What do you want, mister?
I'm looking for Red Eye Kirk.
Ain't nobody here by that name.
Well, maybe you'll do, then.
What?
My name's Ponsett, Brett Ponsett.
Ponsett?
Now, hold on. I'll just take it easy with that gun.
Get him up. Get him up high.
Oh, sure. How's this?
You alone?
Yep, I'm alone.
You must be plumb crazy thinking you can take me single-handed.
No, I'm not interested in taking you, Red Eye.
I told you that ain't who I am.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Yes, you did. Yes, that's right. You mind if I get off my horse?
Well, just don't try nothing, that's all. And don't move toward your holster.
Don't worry.
That's close enough.
Sure.
Now, what are you doing out here, anyway?
Well, the fact is, you see, Mr., what'd you say your name was?
Jones. Bill Jones.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Jones, I've been given the job of raising some money.
What?
Now, don't get me wrong. It wasn't my idea, but since it was for such a good cause, I just couldn't turn the folks down.
Good cause?
A new church organ. That's what I'm collecting for.
What?
You see, the one that Reverend Broom's congregation has been using, it sort of gave up the ghost last night, and what with Easter coming on,
joshing me, mister?
No. No, of course I'm not.
You mean you're out here trying to raise money so you can buy a church organ?
That's right.
Go on. Get moving before I take a shot at you.
You won't give me a hand, huh?
I wouldn't give you 5 cents for every church organ west of the Mississippi River.
Now, it wasn't your money I wanted.
What?
No. No, it wasn't that at all.
What the devil did you come around bothering me for?
Well, I was thinking that, you're a pretty influential man with some of the folks here about.
They've told the mark if I tell them to. You can bet on that.
Yeah, well, that's just the impression I got.
So what?
Well, it seemed to me that if I was to go moseying around these parts alone, some of your friends might not look too kindly on the idea of giving me donations.
They sure wouldn't.
But on the other hand, if we were to approach them together as a kind of a team, you might say.
A team?
That's the general idea, yeah.
You want me to go along with you?
I sure would appreciate it if you would.
And help you raise money for a church organ?
That's right.
Me taking up a Sunday school collection. Well, that's the doggondest notion anybody ever had. What do the boys think? Huh? Jack Denton, Wisconsin Billy? Why, it'd be almost worth it just to see their faces. You sure got a sense of humor, Potson. And you know something, this here crazy scheme of yours, I'm going to take you up on it.
You know something, Mr. Jones?
What?
You know something? I kind of thought you would.
You are listening to The Six Shooter, starring James Stewart as Britt Ponsett, the Texas plainsman whose name has become a legend throughout the great Southwest. And now, Act Two of the story called Crisis at Easter Creek.
Well, the first place we came to was a farmhouse about a quarter of a mile south of Red Eye's cabin. At least it had been a farmhouse once. There sure wasn't any crops growing in the vicinity now. The porch sagged off at a slant, and the windows were stuffed full of papers and rags. Even the front door looked like it was about to slide off its hinges. The place really looked deserted, but Red Eye gave me the nod, and we pulled up and dismounted. Old Red Eye, he had a great big grin as wide as a full moon spread all over his face. Been there ever since we started off.
Hey, Denton! Get out here, Denton! It's me, Red Eye!
Well, I guess you know who I was anyway, didn't you?
Well, I had a pretty good idea.
Howdy, Red Eye. What can I do for you?
Denton, this here's Britt Ponsett.
Ponsett?
Howdy, Denton.
Now, don't you worry, Red Eye. Even if he did get the draw on you, he ain't turning you over to no sheriff.
Oh, put your gun away, Denton.
Huh?
Use your eyes. Ponsett ain't covered me, is he?
Then, what are you doing riding along with him?
Well, we got us a little project. You explain it to it, Ponsett.
Well, the fact is, we're collecting money to buy a new organ for Reverend Broom.
What?
That's right, Jack.
Oh. Sounds to me like you said money for a new organ. I must be getting loco.
I sure ain't gonna argue that with you, Denton. Well, come on. Come on, fork over.
You mean you're serious, Red Eye?
Of course I'm serious.
And he must be holding a gun on you.
I ain't got all day, Denton. How much we need, Britt?
Well, let's see, 12 from 50, $38.
Well, you heard him. Denton?
Oh, sure, Red Eye, sure. Now, just let me look in my purse here. $220 gold pieces. How's that?
Well, I didn't mean that you had to contribute the whole thing.
Just keep the change. Just keep the change.
Oh, well, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. My pleasure entirely. Well, was there anything else, Red Eye?
No, I guess that'll do it for now. Let's go, Ponson.
Yeah, sure. Easy, boy.
I'm glad you boys stopped by. Anytime I can... Well, you know where to find me.
We'll stop at Mike Morgan's place next. That's just down the road.
Well, that's mighty considerate of you, Red Eye, but we don't need to make another stop.
What? Well, what are you talking about?
Well, $38, that's all we needed, you see.
Oh.
See, the organ's all paid for now.
Well, there must be something else the Reverend needs money for, ain't it?
Oh, I suppose.
Well, doggone it, Ponson. I'm enjoying myself. Besides, it wouldn't be fair to the rest of the boys if Denton was the only one who got a chance to do a little contributing to charity. The least we can do is stop at Mike Morgan's, since how we're so close.
I said, well, whatever you say. Whatever you say, Red Eye. Well, we made about 8 more stops before evening, and I must say that all of Red Eye's friends are mighty generous. Why, I even had to turn down the offer of a couple of cows for the cause, seeing as how there was some doubt as to the legal owner of the stock in question. But the gold and the silver and the paper money, well, there just wasn't any way of telling how that was come by. At least, wasn't any way I could think of. So by sundown, I was carrying quite a load of cash. And we were riding away from Slick Wilson's place when Red Eye gave a little sigh and looked at me sort of disappointed.
Well, guess I better head back home now.
Sure, Red Eye, sure. What's the matter?
I was just thinking about how Mike Morgan tripped over his shotgun when I told him what it was we wanted.
Nearly
blowed himself right over the barn.
Yeah, it's kind of a close call, wasn't it?
Doggone it, I don't see why Wisconsin Billy wasn't at home. Well, he'd have been fit to be tied.
Well, we did all right without him, you know.
Say, it's Britt. Oh, why don't you come back tomorrow, huh?
Oh, no.
He'll probably be around there.
Oh, no, thanks, Red Eye. I got a whole lot more than I ever expected. And I sure do appreciate your assistance.
Oh, pleasure's all mine. Well, good luck.
Same to you, Red Eye. It was about an hour's ride back to town, but before I'd gone more than halfway, I got the feeling there was somebody following me. I sure didn't like it either. Not with all this money I had in the saddlebags. So I gave Scar a little touch of the spur. Come on, boy. Come on, let's go. When I heard the other horse pounding up the trail after me, let's go, boy. Come on, let's go. His first shot was over my head, but there wasn't any point in trying to outrun him, Scar being as tired as he was, so I slid out of the saddle and I rolled over behind a rock. He was still coming, so I eased my gun out of the holster and inched up to get a look at him. He was a big fella, holding his revolver loose in his hand like he didn't figure on using it. Well, I didn't figure on letting him rob me either. I waited until he was about even with the rock where I was hiding. Then I stood up.
Drop it! Drop it! Okay, take it easy, Ponson.
Why, you know who I am, huh?
Red Eye told me you was heading this way. I've been trying to catch up with you for the last 15 minutes.
You mean Red Eye sent you after me?
I'll say he did.
Well, I'll be darned. I thought I had him figured different. Now, I suppose he told you about the money, too.
Sure, here's mine.
Hmm?
My share, catch.
What? Your share?
Plymouth Church organ. Name's Wisconsin Billy. I was out when you come by to collect this afternoon.
Oh.
Then I wanted to make certain you got my donation.
Oh, I see.
How'd you mind handing me my gun?
You got it? No, not a bit. Here you are.
Thanks. Well, so long, Ponson.
Well, yes, yes, so long there.
I simply can't believe it, Mr. Ponson. There must be over $1,000 here.
Just about, Reverend, just about.
Enough for the organ, enough to build a church, too.
Yeah? Well...
Mr. Ponson.
Yeah?
Now, you mustn't think me ungrateful, but I'm afraid we can't accept this money.
What?
Well, you see, Sheriff Appleton told me where you got it.
He did, huh?
Now, mind you, I don't have any objections myself. I think when help is offered, it should be accepted, irregardless of the source. But some of my people, they aren't quite so broad-minded. And the idea of permitting Red Eye Kirk and those other outlaws to donate to our fund, well...
Now, just hold on, Reverend Brougham. Now, just hold on. Now, when I was talking to Sheriff Appleton earlier today, he claimed that there weren't any outlaws in the vicinity of Easter Creek.
Well, we don't like to admit that our town is a haven.
The sheriff said that if there were any bandits around here, it was his duty to arrest them. Of course, that would mean getting a posse together. It would probably mean a lot of shooting and killing.
Well, Mr. Ponson, everybody knows it. I mean, it's common knowledge.
And as for Red Eye Kirk ever having anything to do with that money I raised, well, you could be mistaken, Reverend.
But you were seen riding along. Well, it looked like Red Eye.
Didn't Sheriff Appleton ever tell you about the fellow that lives out near Deer Mountain who's supposed to be the spitting image of Red Eye Kirk? Didn't he ever tell you about
it? Now, Mr. Ponson.
No. Even if some of those fellows on the other side of the creek are sort of outside the law. Now, I'm not saying they are, mind you, but even so, you know, accusing them of being criminals, it might stir up a whole lot of trouble.
Well, that's true, of course.
And besides, Sheriff Appleton says they're law-abiding citizens, and he's your duly elected sheriff. He sure ought to know. Hmm? Well, night, Reverend. I'll see you in church. Well, I guess there was a little argument about whether or not to accept the money, but Sheriff Appleton finally convinced folks that they didn't have any right to turn it down. So, by the following Sunday, Easter, the congregation had a new organ. And the service was real well attended, too. Now, some of the folks didn't look like regular churchgoers. But Red Eye, Mr. Jones, he explained to me afterwards that he and his friends just wanted to make sure their contributions had been put to a good use. I don't know if they've been back since, but you never can tell, you know. Reverend Broom preached a real fine sermon that morning.
Shooter is a transcribed NBC Radio Network production in association with Review Productions. It is based on a character created by Frank Burt and is written by him. Mr. Stewart may currently be seen in the Universal International picture The Glenn Miller Story. Others in the cast were Virginia Gregg, Marvin Miller, Ted DeCorsia, Robert Griffin, and Red Eye Kirk. Special music for this program was by Basil Adlam, and the entire production is under the direction of Jack Johnstone. All characters and incidents were fictitious, and any resemblance to actual characters or incidents is purely coincidental. Oh, by the way, you'll be interested in knowing that the six-shooter has been chosen for broadcast to our men overseas through the facilities of the Armed Forces Radio Services. This is John Wall speaking. tonight, play Truth or Consequences with Ralph Edwards on the NBC Radio Network.
You can find more from the NBC University Theater, The Six Shooter, this podcast, and all of the other Relic Radio podcasts at relicradio.com. You'll also find our Shoutcast stream there with even more old-time radio. Lots to listen to there. If you'd like to help out make all of that possible, visit donate.relicradio.com or click on one of the links on the website. Can't do it without your support. Thank you to those who have helped out. Thanks for joining me this week. I'll be back tomorrow with an hour of mystery on Case Closed, and next Tuesday with another episode of the Relic Radio Show.